speaker is going to talk on a topic for a while and then open it up for question and answers. During the question and answer period, if you have a question, please raise your hand and make your question brief and to the point. The question and answer period is not an opportunity to share. It's an opportunity to ask a question. So with that, please join me in welcoming our speaker today, Polly.
Good morning. Polly Pistol, alcoholic. And I am absolutely thrilled to be here this morning. And I was so excited to be at your meeting last night. And I'm like loving Portland AA. And I guess I must be really hungry for good AA because it's been exciting. Thank you so much. When I got invited to talk, to speak, Barb asked me if I'd be willing to do a workshop. And she says, what do you want to do it on? And I said, well, I've done an emotional sobriety here with the women, but I haven't much done that. And emotional sobriety around Portland other than that. So I thought, well, I'll do that. And this is a workshop I've been doing since 1989. And I started doing it the first time I did it. I'm going to just give a little background on it because one of the things that happens is a lot of times when people get invited to do things and you say, well, I can't do that. I mean, I've never done that, say, you know, to do a workshop. And I just kind of want to tell you what happened to me the first time I was asked to do a workshop. I was going to be speaking in Eugene, Oregon. And I always remember exactly when that was because, no, it was 1990. Because I got this book, was given to me as a gift in 1989. And this book is The Language of the Heart. And I'm going to be doing this workshop today from The Language of the Heart. And I don't know if this is a piece of AA literature that you're familiar with, but I believe it's Bill's finest writings. And he writes, I mean, if Bill Wilson could be humble, he was humble in this book. And it's because he starts to say as he got on in his sobriety, because he wrote the last part, which we're going to do, the third part is where I'm going to be taking this from. In the third part, he was coming up on his 24th AA birthday. So he was not a newcomer. And he's beginning to see, and I understand that, how little he knows about recovery. And that's what he's writing about, is how little he knows, even though he wrote the book, how little he knows about his own recovery. And I got invited to do this in Eugene, Oregon. And Julia was going to be with me that weekend. We were going to go down there together, and I thought it was a women's deal, and I was just going to share my story. And so, lo and behold, they call up about, you know, 2 months before the little retreat. I didn't know it was a retreat. I just thought I was going to a women's conference to share my experience, strength, and hope. And she says, what are you doing the retreat on? And I'm like, excuse me? And she said, oh, you are going to do the whole weekend. Oh. So she said, well, do it on something that's important to you. And what I had done is I had just read this book. And I had, and a part of this book that I'm gonna focus on is A New Frontier, Emotional Sobriety. And that, it caught me and it changed my life. So I said, okay. And I am also in the rooms of Al-Anon, so I called my Al-Anon sponsor and I told her what was going on. She says, you know, some Al-Anon lady did something like that down at Brownwood. And I think I even still have the material. So she sent it to me. So always I want you to know, if you'll just say yes, don't know what you're getting yourself into, have no idea what's going to happen, God will provide the rest. So it's kind of evolved over the years. And most of the material that I am a concordance user. I don't know if anybody in here is a concordance user, but I like to be able, when I do a workshop, I like to back it up with AA approved literature, and because I'm really firm about that, because I believe anything else I do is my opinion. So what I'm going to talk about on emotional sobriety today and the stuff that I'm dealing with, I'm going to back it up with, so I'm going to give you the stuff that comes out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe emotional sobriety is steps 6 and 7. So if that's, you know, if you think those are just, you know, sissy little steps, you know, we've only gotten the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we only have 2 paragraphs that cover 6 and 7. But, you know, the deal is that when we're talking character defects, these are killers. You know, the deal is that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that alcohol is but a symptom. And I can guarantee you today, what will kill me today will be my character defects. Because it will be my character defects that cause me to start thinking drinking. And if I don't take care of my character defects, I will drink again. And that's the thing that I need to do. And I believe that God gives us a lot of help. I believe that some of our character defects, as Bill did when he wrote the 7-step prayer, that some of them we just get to hunker down and keep because God for some reason needs them, because he only says that he will remove those that stand in the way of his usefulness, of our usefulness to him. But my character defects are the things that are going to kill me. When I read this, and I should have gotten my little deal out and at least looked it up first. This is on page 236 in The Language of the Heart, and it's called The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety. And what got me, and Bill wrote this in January 1958, and he was just coming up on his 24th AA birthday. And what got me in the little italics, you know, where it stands out, right under the title, The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety, it says, this article is the substance of a letter Bill wrote to a close friend who had troublesome depressions. Now, I don't know if you're in this room and have suffered any kind of depression in and out of your sobriety. But if you are, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, you haven't got a clue, and God bless you. But I know what depression is. I know what it feels like to be so hopeless you cannot get out of bed, and that suicide is definitely a solution. And one of the things that a lot of times that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it usually is always the person who doesn't have the problem, is that when somebody says that they feel like they're going to kill themselves, there are people in AA who do not take that seriously. I'm here to tell you that that is serious. And there are people, I'm talking from experience. When you get in that kind of state of depression, and our co-founder knew about that kind of depression, it is something that it happens to a lot of alcoholics. And maybe you're going to only sit here today and learn what I'm going to talk about a little bit because you have someone you sponsor and you need to give them some help. Or maybe you're sitting here this morning and you're someone who knows about that kind of depression. Either way, if you have experienced that kind of depression, I will tell you, suicide is easy. It's not hard. It's like a relief. It's easy. So when somebody says that to me today, they may be shooting me a line of stuff, okay? And that's okay. But I take it seriously. And I'm here to tell you that the only way I know how to be relieved from depression is to work this program. And I mean work it. all three legacies. Show up at meetings. And you know, what we need to know right now, that this is the unity. This is the fellowship. This is where we gather up together as a group and try to learn and grow. And it can be done in a workshop. It can be done in a meeting. It can be done over coffee. It's important. It is one-third of our program. And people say, well, I'm working the steps. I don't need to go to fellowship. I don't need to go to meetings. Yes, you do. It is one-third of our recovery. It is not, all of it is equally. And the other part is the steps. The recovery part is the steps. And the service is what we get out and do. Somebody put this workshop on this morning. It didn't just materialize. Somebody put it on. I was asked to speak, and as a service commitment, I committed to Barbara. I showed up, and I participated in my own recovery. Now, if you are suffering from depression, I can tell you right now, there is no way you can eliminate any of these conditions, any of them. And I'm one of these people. Somebody says, oh, Polly, you're so busy in AA. You do all this stuff with sponsees, because I sponsor a lot of people. Let me tell you, I don't know what I do for my sponsees. And I sponsor just the way Bill sponsored when he was looking for Dr. Bob, when he needed to work with another alcoholic. I sponsor because my life depends on it. I'm not, you know, sponsorship is not a popularity contest. You know, and I know that there's a lot of people, there's a lot of groups, and I'll hear something, well, I can't get out of that group, and I can't do this because they'll hate me and they'll ostracize me and all this stuff, and that may happen. But you know what? All I want to say is, just remember, we're sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are not the sharpest knives in the drawer, okay? We are sick people. And you know, there may be people around who take that as a popularity contest. And that's okay. Our biggest problem is our ego. And believe me, just because we're sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous does not mean we get well. We don't. If I were well, I wouldn't need to keep showing up. I would be done. But I'm not. I need to continue to treat my disease of alcoholism. So it's not a popularity contest for me. I need every single person I sponsor because I am a person who has had severe depression. I have been diagnosed every kind of psychological or psychiatric disease, manic depression, clinical depression. You know, I've been diagnosed at all. And I can tell you what works for me. What works for me is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And where I do my biggest service for me is I sponsor. That is my biggest service. It's not speaking, even though I'm asked to do that. Unfortunately, I do not sponsor rail at the area level. I can't do that. I'm so glad that my husband's a GSR. I'm so glad my son's a GSR. Any of you who are GSRs and can go to those meetings and not lose your mind, my hat is off to you. My hat is off to you. I'm not that person. But I think we all have our niche in Alcoholics Anonymous. And where I do my greatest service is I sponsor. And what I say is I serve at the group level. And I'm always have a job in my home group. And I believe that every single alcoholic needs a home group. We are people who, if we don't commit, we don't do it. I can't be one of those people. I think maybe I'll do it. You know what we are? You ask an alcoholic to do something and will they? Well, maybe. I'll see. You do a woman to woman, whether it's AA and Al-Anon, You know who are the last ones dragging in? The AA women. Always the Al-Anons are ready. They are, you know, they're doing their thing. They're preparing. And we need to learn to do that. So it's important that I commit, that I take an action contrary to the way I feel. You know how when you commit to something that you're going to do, all of a sudden it's, you get all uncomfortable and it, you know, oh God, I didn't really want to do that. It's important. That's emotional sobriety, commitment. So I began to read this. So that's my service. That's what I have to do. I have to do a lot of service work. I started reading this, and one of the things that I have to make sure of is that my dependency is on nothing but God. And this is what Bill, in this whole article that Bill is writing, is he's talking about the reason he suffered with so much depression is because of faulty dependencies. And I don't know what some of your faulty dependencies are. Maybe you're sitting here today and one of your dependencies is that you need to accelerate in your career. And one of the insanities, when we go to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, let's move over to the big book. To the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the big book, Bill talks about down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. But it may be obscured, which is we're not, you know, it's blinded, we're separated from it by calamity. Anybody got, you know, find how much stuff you can get going in your life so that you don't have to think about God, think about sponsorship. I mean, we can get it going. I mean, I sponsor some women who can get the calamity moving. I mean, you talk about drama queens. I mean, we can get it moving, you know, the calamity. And, you know, maybe you're a crisis junkie. You like everything's a crisis. You love stress. You know, a lot of us love that. I used to love that feeling. That, I mean, your adrenaline gets going and you get that stress on. You know what I loved about it the most when it was working for me? It kept me skinny. It did. It worked. I was getting a benefit from it. Just keep it going. You know, keep that calamity going. Or it may be obscured by pomp. You know, we have huge egos. And, you know, I can get really pumped up. Well, you know, they invited me to Portland, Oregon. I must be something in AA. Well, you know, this is AA. And, you know, and the deal is, I don't know what you do popular about AA. I mean, this is a group of losers who are finding a way to survive the insanity of alcoholism. Let's get honest about who and what we are. You know, we are the people who had no place else to go. But boy, I'll tell you, get a bunch of alcoholics and before you know it, you know, I'm just a little more sober than you, Barbara. I mean, I've got, my sponsorship lineage is better than yours. Insanity. The pomp. Or maybe obscured by other things. Work. That's a good one. That'll do a lot of it. That's what we get in here and all of a sudden, you know, we've been laying in the gutter, but all of a sudden we got to get rich. And, you know, we don't have time to do all the other things. The worship of other things. It can be a lot of things that we worship. Other than we may worship, what is some of the things that I sponsor a lot of women in? They worship their bodies and they spend a ton of time. If they're not throwing up or hurting themselves in some way, they're at the gym 4 hours a day. There's just a worship of all these things of how I look. And I understand that because I had to go there. I mean, it's insanity. But these are the things that will keep us from God. And what Bill says is that I can't have faulty dependencies on anything. And I just wanted... Okay, where did I want to read that? Okay, I'm not seeing it right now, but what he's talking about, I cannot even have a faulty dependency on AA. I can tell you right now, sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous in meetings, being busy, doing all that stuff, unless I have a relationship with God, unless I've done the 12 steps, and unless I have formed a relationship with God, I will not stay sober. I cannot even have a faulty dependency on AA. And that's what he's talking about. I can't have a faulty dependency on anything. My dependencies must lie on God. And the only way that that's going to happen is for me to remove out of my life the character defects which keep me from God. And they can be a numerous and a sundry things. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some of those. I wanted to read that to you because I just think it's so great the way that he had... Find that for me, Dave. Just read it over because I normally have this printed out and I didn't have it. I don't have it printed out tonight, today. So, okay, let's look at some character defects. What I'd like for you to do is look at your character defects like a drink, because they are the things that keep us emotionally drunk. You know, in the 12 and 12, it talks about some days you wake up and you're so emotionally hungover, you feel like you've been drinking all night. So those are some of the things that we can do. We can be so emotionally hungover by the character defects that stand in the way, that obscure us from God. So let's talk about the first one. I think that anger, and I think I'm going to do resentment as well. Yeah, I'm going to do anger, and then I'm going to do resentment. But these two things, we're going to talk about anger first. But what is resentment? Resentment is to feel anger over and over and over. Some of us are rageful. We're just born that way. I was born angry. I think I came out of the chute wanting to kill somebody. And what happened with me is I turned all my rage, a lot of it, inward. The only people that I showed my rage to was my parents, my husband, and my two children. Because you see, there's another addiction I have, and that's addiction to approval. Because always I wanted you to think I was better than I am. And I would show a side to you and another side to my parents. My sons told me many times the thing that made them the most angry was how dishonest and what a big phony I was. And that was, I would be having one of my raging fits screaming at somebody because they didn't do it my way. Because it had to be my way. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. It had to be my way. I'm having this raging fit. The phone rings and I go, "Hi." After I have just abused everybody in my family. Did you find it? Okay. Thank you. All right. Because I had over the years undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute quality of these frightful dependencies had never been so starkly revealed, reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer. I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off the faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA indeed, upon any set of circumstances whatsoever. So I can't have a faulty dependency on anything. And probably one of the biggest faulty dependencies women have is on men. And I've been living with, you know, a man for 25 years that's been willing to share some of his innermost secrets with me over the years. And what I found out is he wants to depend on me just as much as I want to depend on him. So, my God, we didn't have anything going there, you know. Talk about a faulty dependency. Then only could I be free to love as St. Francis had. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions I saw were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love, and expressing a love appropriate to each relation of life. So, you know, my kids can't be an extension of me. I can't depend, Dave's job and how he performs in Alcoholics Anonymous I can't be dependent on that. And I used to give Dave his instructions on how he needed to behave when he went to AA meetings, because Dave's a little, you know, he's not real talkative, and sometimes he can, you know, he can appear rude, and I knew that I had grown when I went to a meeting one night, and one of the women came up to me that I sponsor, and they said, "Is Dave mad at me?" And I said, "I don't know. It's not my night to watch him. You're just going to have to go talk to Dave." And, you know, normally, here I'd go. I was going to fix, you know, I'm in charge. You know, my ego's, I'm in charge. I'd go over there. "Were you not nice to her? Did you not talk to her?" And Dave's looking at me like, you know, he doesn't even get it. And so I finally, you know, you just finally learn that none of that, I don't have to be dependent on that. How other people behave is not my business. It's just not my business. Okay, anger. Let's see. I'm just a deadly poison to sanity and serenity. One of the things that we can do is we cannot, the big book talks about the solution to anger. I'm going to kind of run through these really fast, because when I do this for a weekend or a day, I do it all day. So I'm going to do these like in 25 minutes, okay, or less. The solution, if just one whiff of anger sets up the compulsion to act on it, practice total abstinence. I am a person who cannot afford to get angry. You may can get angry, and you may not. Yours may not progress into rage, but I'm the kind of person that has anger that feeds on itself, and I can feel anger. I don't know if you can. I can feel it. I can feel it in my gut. I can feel it in my temples, and I can feel it in my chest. Learn to pay attention to yourself. That's our job. That's what the steps are all about. Is the first five steps are me getting to know me. I need to learn who and what I am, because I am responsible for my actions, past and present. Restraint of pen and tongue. That's on 91 and the 12 and 12. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. And that's 66 in the big book. And it talks about love and tolerance is our code. And that's in the big book. We have to be willing to listen to other people. And I don't know about you, but I have a hard time with that. I am one of these people, I don't like to wait. I don't know if any type A's are in here. I move, okay? I move. My husband and I have, it's just kind of like a battle. Because I nickname him. I've nicknamed him. It's not even really nice, but I nicknamed him the King of Dottle, because it just seems like I can't get him out the door. You know, I'm just trying to get him out the door. And what am I doing? Where am I going? I mean, what am I doing? It's like I must take at least 15 minutes a day off my life trying to rush to where I need to be, because I think I need to be there, and I think I need to drag him along with me. Just that frustration, that tolerance, no tolerance level. I'm going to talk about intolerance too. Let's talk about resentment. An emotional intoxicant distilled with character defects. Just think about it as a drink. You think that won't poison your life to think about a resentment? You got an old boss you're sitting here thinking about? How about an old lover? How about an ex-husband? How about a parent you think did you wrong? Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When this malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Harboring resentment is infinitely grave. That one I just read is page 64 of the Big Book. Harboring resentment is infinitely grave. Those are huge words. For then we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. That's it now, as Bill sees it. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentments leads only to futility and unhappiness. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. There Bill is with those words again. And he doesn't like to repeat words. Those are big words. So, resentment is a killer. What's the solution? Let's start with a four-step prayer. We ask God to help show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. That's a beginning. And one of the things that, if you're sitting here this morning and you've got huge resentments against your parents, maybe brothers and sisters, what I ask you to do is just look, especially if it's a parent, is to look at their story. Because my challenge to you will be, if you look at your parents' story, it will be so much worse than yours that you will begin to have that magic quality that comes with doing the steps and finding out about ourselves and our parents called compassion. And compassion is the highest form of spirituality, is to have that compassion for another person. And I just also encourage you in your morning meditation that you would sit and look at your parent as a child. Just see them as a child. Because probably what has happened is that they have passed on to you what was done to them. Because there's something that we say in Al-Anon which is so true, and that is, hurt people hurt people. It is an ingrained quality. And most of the time, until we get into programs like this, until we are willing to inventory ourselves, do we ever take a look at it and find a solution? So I just encourage you to do that. Intolerance. I'd like to say intolerance is probably one of the things that kills more AA groups than any single thing. And one of the things is we have a lot of people that come into Alcoholics Anonymous who maybe are not as nice as all of us. Maybe they have some mental illness. And you know, there's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have mental illness. And I'm going to share a little story that's personal. And one of them, we have a little piece of rent property, and it's next door to our house. And this couple was in there, and we just loved them, and everything about them was great. We let them have free reign of the house we lived in, use our washer and dryer. I mean, it was wonderful. And she became mentally ill. And in 2 months, that unraveled so bad that she ended up practically destroying the trailer and fits of rage. So one of the things, and you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, aren't you mad about that? You know what I'm grateful for? If it were not for this program, that's me. And I'm watching her little three-year-old boy as she has all these fits of rage and carrying on. And you know what? That was me. That was me doing those very things to my sons. Having fits of rage, screaming, calling them names, kicking doors in. You know, I'm sure that's none of you guys. But I want you to know that that's me. That is me without you. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. Bill used that word, stupidity. That's on page 103 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I challenge you, if you come from the sponsorship that only reads to page 86, I challenge you to read further. There really is a lot of stuff in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things that the solution, what is the solution? We've got signs, maybe there's signs, but there's usually signs, live and let live. A lot of times we talk about an open mind, love and tolerance. Start to realize that there are people who have challenges that we don't have. We must be careful. The other thing is that one of the most intolerant things that we can do is that how I treat myself a lot of times is how I'm going to treat you. And if I have all these high expectations on myself that I can't even begin to live up to, I'm going to put those on you. And the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, we must be careful not to drift into remorse and morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. You ever been around somebody who talks about, I'm stupid, I can't do this, I'm no good. Oh, I have my oldest son does that. Sometimes I would just, like to just, scream, shut up. I don't want to hear this. But a lot of times that's what we do. So we can't drift into that. Try to have a positive attitude. Self-pity. Anybody have problems with self-pity? Self-pity is one of the most unhappy and consuming defects. That's what Bill called it. Defects, we know. It is the bar to all spiritual progress and can cut off effective communication with our fellows because of its inordinate demands for attention and sympathy. It is a maudlin form of martyrdom which we can ill afford. And that's in As Bill Sees It. So, you ever know how you can begin to feel self-pity coming on? I can tell you this is my number one defect. Absolutely. I am, in fact, I'm going to do this because I have a little thing written out here when I do this at a workshop. Have you, Julian, I can do it really good. Self-pity. Nobody loves me. Nobody likes me. Nobody wants to be around me. I'm just so stupid. Nobody loves me. Everybody's against me. I can't do anything right. I might as well be dead. Anybody ever have those little things? Are you any of you subject to fits? I'm subject to fits, so. Of self-pity. Ask my poor husband. He's endured a lot over the past 25 years. What's the solution? We ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that we be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. Avoid, then, the deliberate manufacture of misery. Have any of you ever had any misery that's going on that is so horrible and 5 years later can even really remember what it was? That's how important it is. That's most of it. I'm not saying that's all of it. Some of us have had tragedies that will be with us all the days of our lives. But many of us have absolutely gone into making ourselves sick, and 5 years later can't even remember what the problem is. Avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery, but if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. And that's on 133 in the big book. Love the family afterwards. Love it. There's the good stuff. If you're not familiar with that chapter, I challenge you to read that chapter. There's so much good stuff in it, positive stuff. Jealousy. Anybody have trouble with jealousy? I used to. I don't have so much trouble with it anymore because my husband's old and I'm old. But my husband, and he does to this day, loves young women. Just absolutely loves them. And he's never been inappropriate. He just loves young women. But I can tell you, when I was 40-some-odd years old, I did not like it. And I was really jealous of these women. And, I mean, it was like they were all younger than me, and worst of all, they were all thinner than me, and he adored them. And I was really jealous. And I'm here to tell you that jealousy will rot your soul. Keep it always in sight that we are dealing with the most terrible human emotion. You hear what Bill just said? And that's in the first 86 pages. That's on page 82. We are dealing with the most terrible human emotion, jealousy. The greatest enemies of us alcoholics are resentment, jealousy, envy, frustration, and fear. And that's on page 145. What can I do about jealousy? Well, one of the things that I need to do is I need to inventory it. Steps 4 and 5. I need to find out about my jealousy. And what I do, one of the things, my son was barely sober. I can't remember. You know, you can learn things from the mouths of babes. And I was having this terrible jealous moment from a woman that I sponsor. And James looked at me and he said, "Mom, it's your perception." One of the things we have to see is look at our perception. Because, see, we don't perceive things the way they really are. And James says, "Mom, it's your perception. Dave sees these women as a daughter or a child, and you see these women as a woman." Two different ways to look at things. It's amazing. If you just are willing to inventory, you can begin to get free of the things that keep us in bondage, these character defects that shut us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. Dishonesty and deception. I call them the DTs. The book is constantly going through and talking about dishonesty and deception. What we do is we lie by omission. That is deception. Okay, I didn't out and out lie, but I just didn't tell you the whole truth. So what we have to do is we have to try and all that we can to be honest. Now, I can tell you the place that I have the hardest time practicing honesty is in my marriage. That's where I have the hardest time. And you know why I have the hardest time? My kids, it's easier. Because they're my children. My God, with what I've drugged them through, and they love me anyway. If I have to tell them something, they're going to love me anyway. They're my children. So that relationship is safe. The other relationship that is the most important relationship in my life is my relationship with my husband. And sometimes it's really hard for me to be honest in this relationship. And it takes an enormous amount of prayer for me to ask God to just get in the big book where it says, you know, just ask God to direct my thinking and my actions so that I can be honest with my husband. Because there are things that are going to eat me up if I'm not honest with my husband. And I can remember early in our marriage, well, we'd been married about 10 years, so it's not too early in our marriage, and Dave would hide things from me. And I'd say, you need to be honest with me. And he says, Polly, it's too hard to be honest with you. I cannot guarantee, you know, because of your reaction. And see, that, what are we afraid of? See, it's that fear. I'm afraid he's going to leave me. I'm afraid he's going to be angry at me. And what I realized is that he cannot, at that point, I knew I could not guarantee my reaction when Dave was honest with me. What that helped me do is be compassionate, that if I'm honest with him, he cannot guarantee his reaction. But it's important, if I'm going to have a relationship that is going to still be fulfilling 25 years later, I've got to learn some honesty. And I've got to learn it in this relationship. I live with him every day. So I've got to learn honesty. And that's where it's been the hardest place for me to practice honesty. Criticism. I don't believe that there's any such thing as constructive criticism. I believe that criticism, most of the time, when we start criticizing someone, our intention is to hurt. I don't, you know, somebody will say, well, I'm just trying to help you out. There isn't any such thing as constructive criticism, I don't believe. I think that one of the greatest things that we do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is how we share. And that is, it is my experience, if you do this, this will happen. Instead of telling somebody where they're wrong, why they're wrong, I mean, what happens? What is your reaction when somebody does that to you? Back off. I'm not going to hear you. So what I can usually do is what I've learned to do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is to come from, it is my experience. Fear. We are people who are driven by 100 forms of fear. Nothing is more self-centered than fear. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroded thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. Sometimes we think fear ought to be classified with stealing. It causes more trouble. That's on page 67. What is the solution to fear? The biggest solution is 4 and 5. We need to go find out what our fears are. And one of the things that's my experience and I want to share with you is that all three inventories are terribly important. And I know we talk about the resentment inventory the most, and that's the one that's lined out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know how you work steps. I mean, however you do it, I know how Barbara works steps because Barbara comes from my sponsorship lineage, and that is, it's right out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know how Sylvia works steps because she is a sponsee. So, we do steps right out. And the only one that's given, you know, gives us kind of how to do it is the resentment inventory. And then a lot of people will go try to do the fear inventory and the sex inventory using that format. That's not it. You have to go look and you have to go back and read about the fear inventory. The columns are different in the fear inventory. We need to find out what we're afraid of. And I mean everything. You know, one of the things, I listened to Bob Darrell a couple of weeks ago. He didn't think he had any fears. And, you know, the man walks up to him. He asks this man about fears, and he says, well, what about snakes? Well, everybody's afraid of snakes. And Bob said, you know, the guy said, but Bob, we're not talking about everybody. We're talking about you. So what about mean dogs? Well, everybody's afraid of a mean dog. But Bob, we're not talking about everybody. We're talking about you. So we need to begin to list our fears and find out what we're afraid of. Why am I afraid? And what should I do instead? Different inventory. then. And the main thing is, what I like to do, fear. What am I afraid of? Why am I afraid? Third column, where did I set the ball in motion? Where did I set this fear up? Think about fear of financial insecurity. I've got that right now. Most of the time, you know, that one kind of stays after all the financial stuff we've been through. That one kind of stays at bay. Right now, we're, you know, we live on a fixed income, and we've got a lot of expense with fixing up this trailer and stuff like that. And I'll get into that place. Well, we only have this much money in our 401k, and when that's gone, that's it. And there ain't no more coming, okay? It's not going to, you know, in my head, it's not going to magically appear. So I get into that financial fear. Well, where did I set the ball in motion? I can tell you where I set it in motion. I set it in motion back in June to start with, when I went to the International and spent way more money than I should have, and put that on a credit card and then had to pay for it. Okay? See, when I go and I see where I put the ball, where I set the ball in motion, I can begin to see where I've set up myself to be fearful now in a situation where I have very little control of. Inventory, steps 4 and 5, the beginning of the solution for fear. How about the fear prayer? You know how many prayers are in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? We have a prayer just about for everything. You want a prayer? Go through the book. We got a prayer. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us to do. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Now, I don't know if you've outgrown it, but I'm still commencing to outgrow it. I mean, I can tell you right now, I'm sitting in financial fear of financial insecurity. How about steps 10 and 11? Do we work step 10 every night? I sponsor a woman who writes it every night. Barbara, I just admire her so much. She writes a 10th step every single night. I wish I could be as disciplined as her. I'll lay down in the bed and kind of think about it. So, but the best way to do it is to write it and answer all the questions that the big book asks. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. So if you're a newcomer, you know, I hate to discourage you, but it's a lifetime. Okay, the other one is that the blame train. Anybody ride the blame train? It's so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. I don't need to say anything else about blame. That's it. I am the problem. And the 10th step in the 12 and 12, it says that it is a spiritual axiom. Whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. My problems do not belong to anybody else. And if you're sitting in here and you've got childhood trauma and you are still smarting from that childhood trauma, I am really sorry. But today you are an adult and you have got solutions in order to work through childhood trauma and let your childhood trauma be your greatest asset. Because we do have solutions, so that today you do not have to be paralyzed by childhood trauma. There is help. On page 133 in the big book, it tells us not to belittle professionals. Go seek out professional help. I am sure that you're not talking to your sponsor, and that is the only solution you have today for MS. I would imagine that you probably have physicians, psychologists, all kinds of stuff that are working with you. Seek out help. There are people who stand in AA and say, the only thing I've ever done is AA. And you know what I do? I'm like, God, that's sad. When you have got, you're sober. You have been given the benefit now to be able to grow through other ways because you're sober. Amazing what is available to us. God has given us so many fabulous professionals that we can seek out help. And the last one I want to talk about is depression, and then I'm going to I'm going to throw it out to questions. I want to just say, if you are sitting here this morning depressed, that it is my opinion that it is the highest form of self-centeredness. And it is my experience because it is something I've battled all my life. And I don't think it is any mistake that probably 50% of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because Bill was one part of AA and Dr. Bob was another, that about 50% of us suffer from depression. Well, why wouldn't we? Selfishness and self-centeredness, we believe, is the root of our illness. And I believe that because what happens is, it's what my AA sponsor Dottie says, Polly, it's not necessary you think well of yourself. It's just you think only of yourself. So what I need to do is the way I have an antidote for depression. The first thing I have to do is get out of bed. It's important that I get up and get moving and start doing something that will start the endorphins going. The next thing I need to do is maybe pick up the 200-pound phone and call somebody and be able to talk to them. And I do not, if they ask how I'm doing, you know, it's like, I'm doing good today. I am doing good. I'm calling you. And that's what I'm doing. And get the subject moved back to them. I do not need to talk about me when I am depressed. The next thing I need to do is I need to start doing something of service. When I have, one of the things that a lot of times, especially Sylvia is just such a sweetheart, and she's one of those, well, I don't want to bother you. You're really busy. Bother me. Without you, I'm going to die here. You see, I need the people I sponsor because I am a person that is in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that cannot spend 1 minute in my own head thinking about me. I can't do it. You may can do it. I can't do it because I never think well of myself. I think only of myself, but it's never well. So what I have to do in order to get the endorphins going is I have to do an esteemable act. And if I will sit and listen to the women I sponsor and turn my attention to them, I start to get better. Now, I've learned that. I can drive people who love me crazy because I'm with the cell phone all the time. And I know Dave one day, a few months ago, and this is our life, he came to me and he said, you're going to have to watch your cell minutes. I said, no, I'm not. You're going to have to get a new plan. Because you see, this is my lifeline. This is what's going to save my life. And if I have to give up something else, I'll give it up. But it is not going to be my lifeline to communication, because what's keeping me alive is the language of the heart, and that's one alcoholic helping another alcoholic. That's the magic. That's it. That's a magic. And we are in an age where communication is fabulous. And I don't ever have to worry about dying of depression because I can't pick up the phone or I don't have a quarter to make a phone call because I'm not at home. We are in that era of technology, and I can tell you because of that, I have been better than I have ever been because I have been able to practice service in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the magic of one alcoholic working with another alcoholic as many hours as I'm awake, and I love it. So, open for questions. Hi, Tom.
Talk about abortion sobriety. I'd like you to speak about forgiveness.
Okay. That's great. Forgiveness. I think that forgiveness is the highest form of one of the highest forms of spirituality. Because if I don't, and personally, if I don't learn to forgive, and one of the things that also happens, Tom, is I see people come into AA without doing the work and say they have forgiven, but they haven't. And the only way I know how to forgive is to go through the fourth and fifth step, make a list of the people I've harmed, and then go make amends. Now, I don't know how it works. I just know it works. But when I'll go make amends, for whatever reason, I start to feel the feeling of forgiveness. And that'll be to people that I don't think I even owe an amends to. But they think I owe an amends. And I believe what the book says. I have to make amends whether real or imagined. And I've gone and made, and I'm going to use a little story. I had a gal got really mad at me at our home group, and she ended up leaving. And she thought that I had somehow set one of my sponsees up to be secretary of that group. I didn't. If she only knew that a bunch of guys and gals went to a camp out, and they thought, boy, she would make a really good secretary. My husband was part of it. And that's how she got nominated. Had nothing to do with me. But this lady got mad at me, and she resented me. And Frank Honeycutt, who is in the big meeting in the sky now, was Dave's sponsor. And this was at the San Diego Roundup, the San Diego International. And I went and talked to Frank, and he said, you will make amends to her. And, I mean, I couldn't really see how I owed her an amends. And he says, she thinks you do. And what happened was I went and made amends to her and told her how sorry I was that she was hurt. And, you know, for any of the actions that I had done. I really wasn't sure what they were, but I just was sorry for them. And I want you to know that I was free that moment. And I had forgiveness and compassion for her. That woman to this day cannot look me in the eye. Because she didn't get the forgiveness. So I just know that that set me free. So step nine is the thing that I believe is the thing that helps me find that wonderful, wonderful freedom of forgiveness. Even when I think they owe me more than I owe them. Did I answer it? Okay. Yes.
When you talk about not being able to think even for a moment about your own self. I'm Lisa, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa. Hi, Lisa.
And then right before that we were talking about availing ourselves of professionals.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, I have a hard time reconciling how one avails oneself of the bounty of professional help, if that's what you're referring to, or experts or whatever, without talking about oneself. And then the other side of the question is, or focusing on one's own problems. The other side of the thing is, I just in my mind, I can't reconcile the only cure for say depression being to help another person with what you said about availing yourself of professionals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one of the things that it does. And one of the things is also, how far in the steps are you? Okay. So you haven't started your amends yet. Okay. One of the things, and that's all right, because that's exactly where you need to be. And that's true. And one of the things that I think that we also have to do when we're seeking out professional help is that we also have to be, you know, discerning of who we choose. Because one of the things that will happen is that psychology, one of the things that I don't think they mean to, but it seems like they do kind of keep us in a victim role. You know, that people did it to us. But I believe that if people are trying to help us, that they will show us how these people are not to blame. We can't blame these people. These people are sick people. So in that sense, it's going to be like you talking about your inventory. What I'm saying is when you go and talk with somebody, hopefully what I'm if you are doing that, I'm hopefully you're with somebody who will give you back a solution and not keep perpetuating the problem. Because that's what people like you and I can't handle. That will keep us sick forever. And one of the things my husband and I did some stuff years ago. Everybody remember when the inner child thing was going on? Go find your inner child. Somewhere in here there's a little kid. God, is there ever a little kid in there? You know, what I am desperately trying to find is an adult. Because I... We don't think like adults. We are, the book talks about, we are people who are just too sensitive. You know, one of the things I have to learn to do is, because I'm selfish and self-centered, I have to remember the world doesn't revolve around me. And yeah, I want to know about myself so I can get well. But I can tell you, a lot of people go to therapy only to tell their troubles to, so they can get validated for why they hurt so bad. And then you'll remain sick. But there are therapists who don't do that. And let me tell you right now, if you are someone that I sponsor and you come to me, and especially if you have had sexual violation, or maybe what's happened to you is some horrific child abuse, I am not equipped to handle that. I am not equipped. I do not have a medical degree. I do not have medical insurance. I am not equipped to handle that. There are people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous who have psychiatric diagnosed illnesses and need medications and whatever. Now, I believe that the world is over-medicated, but that doesn't mean that there are people who need that. And I am not a physician, and I am not about to diagnose these people and say, you shouldn't take that. So what we have to do is be discerning. And hopefully, if you're going to a therapist or you're seeing a psychiatrist, that you will care enough about yourself to find out, if you don't feel like you're getting better and you don't feel like there's a solution available here, that all we're talking about is we're just digging up and digging up and digging up. Chuck C. used to say, uncover, discover, and discard. One of the things that happens with therapy is we uncover and we discover 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 and we never get rid of it. So what happens is I think we need to be mindful of that. And I'm sure that you've got a sponsor in your life, and they will help you. And I try to at least point people in the right direction. But I believe that there's professional help. I don't know how to deal with a lot of that stuff. I mean, it's not my experience. It hasn't happened to me. I have a few women that I sponsor. I want to talk about forgiveness, Tom, about thing, but what you're bringing up. I sponsor a woman who was sexually abused by her father until she was 16 years old. And I want you to know that through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, she did not go to therapy. And I didn't sponsor her till after she had worked on this. But she did not go to therapy. But through strong sponsorship and a sponsor who had the same experience, because I don't, she uncovered and discovered. And she went to her dad when it came time to make amends, and made amends for the things she had done to harm him. He never asked her forgiveness for having violated her from the age of 4 to 16. Never did. But when he died, she loved him and cared for him and cherished him. But she never lost responsibility. She has 2 children. Never did she ever leave those children at her mother and father's house without being present. So she was a responsible parent. However, she had reached a place of total forgiveness for her father. Because what she learned about her dad was, is that he had been an orphan, and he had lived on the streets, and he had been violated by men and women. And see, to him, he didn't understand that it was wrong. Before I tell you my story, let me tell you my parents' story. Most of the time, we will find answers that will help us to get to that place of forgiveness. Any more questions?
In regards to the 10th step, you said that nightly you just do a review in your head. Do you do a written 10th step at all?
Yes.
And how often? And well, what does that consist
when my
of?
Ass has fallen off. I wish I had a better answer, Chris. Yeah. You know, I have to write it time to time. I have this Al-Anon friend. We used to work together, and we didn't work together. We worked close to each other, I meant. And I was forever reading her 10 steps. But yeah, I do, you know, I do 10 steps when they come up. So, but I tried to absolutely review my day every day. And, you know, most of the time, because I live with Dave, you know, we're together all the time now that we're, you know, now that we're retired. And I tend to owe him quite a few amends. I've been known to be kind of a bossy bitch. They even used to call me that at my AA group in California. And Dave sometimes takes real offense to that. So I wish it were better than that, but yeah, I do. I do 10 steps. I just did one about 3 weeks ago. I read it to one of my AA babies. She was available. I read it to her. I'm not above that, you know. I kind of sponsorship on a Bill and Bob relationship, especially with women who have a lot of sobriety. And I sponsor women that have one, well, Pam has one less year than me. So, I mean, I got a lot of women that are over 25 years of sobriety. So, believe me, most of them got better answers than I do. So. Yes.
When we get to our darkest place, or when I get to my darkest place in depression, it's hard to make isolation is my mm-hmm. where I go.
I understand.
How do we protect ourselves from that and make that first step? Make that phone lighter.
I don't know that it's going to be lighter. All I know is that the first thing I have to do is get out of bed. That's the hardest thing I have to do. And maybe go take a walk. And none of these things do I do without effort. And, you know, and I know you know what I'm talking about when I talk about effort. Just absolutely have to make yourself do it. The way I kind of, you know, kind of keep it away from me is I just, like I said, I'm on that cell phone all day long. And we'll be driving down the freeway, you know, or especially I have to drive to Seattle 2.5 hours to catch an airplane. And so I do that really often. A lot of times Dave's with me, and I'll be on the phone, and after about an hour and a half, 2 hours, he'll just say, I've had it. Hang it up. You know, I just can't listen to you on that phone anymore. But I know now how to keep it from going there, the actions I try to take. You know, just, you know, it's like doing the program. I'm a very structured person. I am less structured since I've been retired. But when I was working, you could have set your clock by me. And I'm a very structured person, and I still have to maintain that structure. I can't decide on Monday night that, oh, I don't think I'll go to my home group. I can't do that. I have 3 committed meetings a week, and, you know, I'm there. I have to keep that structure up. I have call-in phone calls. And I keep that structure going. And I'm usually saved by my sponsees because they'll call and I'll say, oh, hi, Sylvia. And she'll say, it's Thursday or Wednesday. Which day are you? Thursday. Wednesday. She'll say, "It's yeah, you, Robbie's before you, and then you." And she'll say, "It's Wednesday." "Oh, hi, it's Wednesday. I'm retired. I don't know what day it is." You know? So thank God. And thank God I answer my phone. Answer your phone. You know the big other one? Return phone calls. Return. What is the rudest thing in the world? Is someone to call and you don't call back. How does that feel when it happens to you? Don't do that.
Well, thank you for coming in and being with us this morning. And what I'm curious about is how long it took for you to have the restoration of the trust and love of your children in your sobriety. When approximately did that take place? I know sometimes a lot of us are looking for immediate gratification on that kind of thing. And when you keep your focus on the program and on God, how much time did it take for them to be able to exercise the forgiveness and trust and begin to love you again?
My youngest son, it was quickly, okay, because he'll be 22 years sober. And he was 18 years old. No, he was 16 years old when I got sober. And he and I had always been closer, but just for whatever reason. I was doing AA stuff. Dave and I had AA people at our house all the time. You know, he just, and I don't know if, and it's because he hasn't done his own work. So he's not ever really forgiven me. And if you don't have to be around him for very long to know that he's angry at me. So when it comes to them forgiving you, forgiving me, I don't know that he has. I just know that our relationship today is better than it's ever been. But I don't know that he's forgiven me, Rich. I don't think he has. And he's still real angry. Well, I don't think. I know he's angry. I can feel it. Everybody else can feel it, too. I think he still blames me for his problems, for what's wrong with him. And he, you know, I'll tell him, I say, Russ, the best way, and it's true, the very best way to heal is if we're able to talk person to person. And I say, I have a program. If you want to talk to me, I believe that if anybody who goes to parents, brothers or sisters or children who do not have a program and lay any stuff on them, I think that is inhumane. And I think therapists want us to confront our perpetrators or our offenders. And I think that is not right, because those people do not have any tools in which to handle stuff like that. And I have been given those instructions when Dave and I were doing some therapy, and I am so grateful today that, and I've been willing to, but I have a way to handle it. And I've asked him, you know, to do, you know, if he wants to talk to me. And he says, "I'm not angry. A lot of people had it worse than we did." You know, and I'll just turn his arms over because they're all cut up. And if you see his stomach, it's worse. And his thighs are even worse than that. And I can turn it over. And I say, "No, Russ, you had a perfect childhood, you know. That's why you're doing all this stuff." But he can't do it. And so he stays stuck. It's that, you know, I know you know people who you love, they're just stuck. And it's heartbreaking, especially when it's your child. And, you know, I say, if you can't talk to me, just talk to somebody. But he can't do it. His pride and his ego won't allow him to do that. So, it's not good. It's not healed. It's just better.
So, what